Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie zu einer wirklich sehr speziellen Sonderausgabe von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt. Wir widmen uns heute der Geopolitik, der internationalen Konfliktlage und diesem brodelnden Chaos, das uns dazu umgeben scheint. Und ich habe dazu gewinnen können, zum ersten Mal in dieser Sendung einen ganz renommierten Experten, einen früheren Diplomaten und auch Konfliktlöser, einen Unterhändler. Es handelt sich um Alistair Crook. Alistair Crook ist britischer Staatsbürger. Er ist ausgebildet worden, allerdings in Eglon in der Schweiz. Und wie er mir erzählte, hat die Schweiz ihn auch stark geprägt. Er war dann tätig im diplomatischen Dienst für Großbritannien, für die Europäische Union und hat sich vor allem in Konfliktsituationen als Entschärfer, gewissermaßen als Therapeut und Lösungsbeauftragter profiliert, insbesondere auch im Nahen Osten, in Tschetschenien und in verschiedenen Minenfeldern der Geopolitik. Wir werden ein Gespräch führen in zwei Teilen. Im ersten Teil, den wir jetzt ausstrahlen, geht es vor allem um Russland, um die Ukraine, um Europa und die Vereinigten Staaten. Und wir werden ein zweites Gespräch führen, wo wir uns dann ausschließlich dem Nahostkonflikt widmen. Und jetzt stelle ich um auf Englisch, weil unser Gesprächspartner zwar in der französischen Schweiz ausgebildet wurde, aber des Hochdeutschen weniger gut mächtig ist als ich des Englischen. Therefore, I will switch to English and I give a warm welcome to Alistair Crook. It's great to have you in our program. Many thanks. And as I've learned, you are now in Rome. Is that correct?
Yes, that's where I'm based in Italy now. Yes.
And I have forgotten something to mention, because you are the director of the Conflict Forum now. You are a retired diplomat, but now the director of the Conflict Forum, which is a geopolitical think tank. Mr. Crook, dear Alistair, let's start with a very general question. What is the state of the world right now?
It's a very serious state that we have, because in a sense we have serious conflicts that are brewing, both in the Middle East and of course within Europe, in Ukraine, and a conflict that is seemingly to be increased. All the language you get from Europe at the moment, all the European leaders are sort of gripped by a war fever against Russia. And I've learned from experience in these things that sometimes these things develop their momentum. I mean, they become a sort of psychological, they are a psychosis, a mass psychosis amongst leaders, not among the ordinary people. But the sort of psychosis takes you forward. I saw, the momentum when I was responsible for what was happening in Afghanistan at the time of the Soviet invasion of involvement with Afghanistan. I saw that very clearly, that, this thing had a huge momentum. It had a huge dynamic. And it was very difficult, if you like, to sort of pull it up or steer it very easily during that time. So we have that. We have in Gaza and in Israel a conflict in which the Israeli people are completely divided in two. There are completely two different, if you like, spheres. One of them was typically Ashkenazi, in other words, European Jews, traditionally liberal, westernized. And then at the last Israeli election, suddenly we saw the Mizrahi, who are Jews that come from North Africa and from the Middle East suddenly were walking into the Prime Minister's office and being given cabinet posts. And they had a very different worldview from the previous incumbents there. The Ashkenazi, the liberal, these are the people from the kibbutzes and from that part of life. And they came in with a particular agenda, which was radical, striking. The first, it had three main components. The first of this was they would wanted to found Israel on the land of Israel, to found Israel again on the land of Israel, which means effectively, at least from the river to the sea, and maybe to the Euphrates, and up to the Litani, depending on which definition. But even if you just call it from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean, this means, in effect, no Palestinian state. Just to be clear, that's what it implies. Palestinians as sort of sub-citizens in the state, maybe, but not there as a state in any way. Then the second one was to build the third temple, the third Jewish temple on Haram al-Sharif Temple Mount. But that, just to be clear, meant knocking down Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is increasingly the key icon, not just as a mosque, but it represents, you know, 1,000 years of Islamic civilization. I mean, it's something that is really key to people's identity. Sadly, so much of the, you know, Mecca and Medina have become more a shopping center than something that people go to for spiritual reasons. And the third one was halakhic law, the implementation of halakhic law and Talmudian law. And that meant, and you see that reflected in what's happening in Gaza, because we see the talk of Amalek, a biblical person, tribe it was, and you see it in the book of Isaiah. And in that, Yahweh instructs King Saul to kill all the Amalek without exception. Women, children, beasts, all were to be destroyed. And when I look at the sort of videos coming out of Gaza these days of young Israeli soldiers, and they're dancing and singing about Amalek, and the rabbis are there too saying, listen, killing the women and children is actually a religious obligation. It's not something optional. That is part of the Talmud, and this is what you must do. This is the request. And of course, it was taken up by Netanyahu first, used this word. So just to complete your sort of picture, a really completely divided Israel, not susceptible to the usual secular institutional peace processes. Two-state solution, all those solutions, because they are in a different vein. They are looking to a biblical solution, Armageddon, if you like, Masada, if you like. And then, in a sense, they are trapped. And there's no way out of this trap that is very obvious, because on all sides they're pressed. Then that is feeding into the West in a very clear way, because there is an interconnection between our leadership structures, particularly in the United States. I mean, the institutional leadership structures of the United States, much of them are either Zionist or evangelical, and the same in parts of Europe. And so there's a direct interconnection between, if you like, the impasse in Israel and the impasse that is growing in the United States as well. And then we have Ukraine. But I think I'll stop there.
Very interesting what you're saying, Alistair. If I understand you correctly, or if I make an interpretation, one can say that we have a very religious dimension in the war situation in the Middle East, but we have also some kind of pseudo-religious mass hysteria of the leaders vis-a-vis Russia and increasingly China. Is our world in a state of war fever, or our leadership in a state of war fever? How dangerous is it now? Are we stumbling into kind of a scenario of a third world war? How realistic is a huge escalation of these two minefields?
I think you are exactly right. And I think we are in a particularly dangerous period, this period. In a sense, there is a direct parallel between the two. You called it a sort of secular eschatology that is gripping the West, in that, you know, it does still see itself as having a missionary purpose to convert the West to its vision of the future and its vision of a way of living. And it is intent on imparting its values. So this is the sort of missionary redemptive element, if you like, the eschatological. I know eschatological and secular don't seem to go together very well, but in a sense, underlying the secularism are some of these deep religious impulses.
These mirrors somehow the biblical dimension of the conflict in Gaza. This is a very interesting observation, I think, that you are making here. Let's focus on the war in Ukraine, because in our next edition, we will focus on the Middle East.
Yes, I would just say, to finish off in the sense, is, you know, the interconnection of the power structures in Israel with our own in terms of media and the actual institutional leaderships and things, is that we have also got some of the same problems, including the tendency to have an immediate resort to what Putin, I think, in 2007 called a hyper use of force by the West in order to ensure its monopoly domination. He said that at the Munich Security Council, even in 2007, and warned that this was not, you know, acceptable to Russia even then, and said, we will, we accept the challenge. We will prepare for it. So in the sense, the Israeli, you know, immediate resort is to overwhelming military force, either in Gaza or in the region, to restore deterrence. And also for the United States, going back even to the sort of Mackinder and the Brzezinski view, that there can be no challenger from Eurasia to the West, and that must be met by overwhelming force. And so the two, I mean, in a strange sense, are marching in parallel together in terms of their zeitgeist, their foreign policy zeitgeist. I mean, not in a strict religious sense, because one is more Protestant and evangelical and the other is different. But they are marching. And in Ukraine, we have the Ukrainian conflict goes back a long way. But what has made it so intractable is that there was always a civil war within Ukraine. Before this started, between, if you like, Luhansk and Donbass, and the west of Ukraine, which had quite different roots and antecedents. And what has made this so intractable is that if there's a parallel, I would say it's something like Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. I mean, I was involved with that. And there you have people with completely different visions of their history, completely different visions of their future. And you can't just put them in a room together and say, sort it out, because that doesn't work. You have to get to a position where each side will accept that the other side has a point and is a legitimate, it has a legitimate argument. And that never happened. That's why the Minsk agreements all failed, because it wasn't going to happen. But the bigger problem in this is about identity politics, because for old reasons, I can go into it, but I don't want to take too much time on it. But the western part of Ukraine came to see themselves as having a different identity, partly during the interwar period, when they were part of the Wehrmacht, the 14th division of the Wehrmacht. And Germany was going through that period when racial thinking was becoming very prominent. And so the Ukrainians that were in the Wehrmacht adopted a sense of a new identity, which they thought would appeal very much to Germany. So they said, well, we're not Slavs at all. We're really actually Viking stock. And our language is an old, old language from another era. So we're not like those Slavs at all. And even you'd have the head of the National Security Council saying, you know, we can cope with Asians, from Kiev, the head of the National Security Council. But those Slavs, they're subhuman. We don't deal with those. And this has been fostered as a means of undermining Russia. And the European Union has taken this up with alacrity and sort of regards the Dnieper, the river dividing Ukraine, you know, that they're Europeans. It's totally bogus. All the DNA and all the evidence shows that all the Ukrainians are both sides of the, if you like, Dnieper, are Slavs. Their language is actually a dialect of Russian. It's nothing to do with German or any other part of it. But this identity issue makes coming to a negotiated settlement that much more difficult, because Europe says, they're Europe. Ukraine is Europe, and we must defend it, and we must fight for it. Well, they're fighting for something that is totally false, for a start, because they're not. You can say some of them have got Hungarian roots or Romanian roots, but they are basically both Slavs and of one people. But the old idea of negotiations, which I was sort of brought up on, was about interests, not identities. When you move to the identity level, it's much harder, if you like, to find any grounds in which you can negotiate. That was the lesson I took from Northern Ireland and was very clear. And so the failure of Minsk was which largely, you know, the Europeans triggered. I mean, Merkel and Macron, I mean, they triggered the failure, which Minsk was really an attempt, like in Northern Ireland, to try and find some sort of modus vivendi between two communities that had quite contradictory, if you like, versions of history and visions of the future. Well, that hasn't worked, and so now we're in a conflict. And as I'm speaking to you, it seems to be coming to some early resolution. The front lines of the Ukrainians are just crumbling all around Kharkov. All their reserves are already in play in shaping up Kharkov. And now the big scandal is revealed that actually there are no defensive lines built. Mm. And everyone and within Kiev, people are screaming at each other and saying, why are there no defensive lines then? I mean, we spent billions on this, billions of money to do this. Mm-hmm. They've been stolen. The money's been stolen. The defensive lines are not there. So village after village, town after town is effectively just collapsing to the Russian forces.
Fascinating. If you look at Swiss newspapers, German newspapers, you could say, the consensus also among our elites in the West, in Switzerland, you name it, they say the evil Putin, this kind of new Hitler or new Stalin or new Genghis Khan, he's an imperial dictator, and we have to stop him, otherwise he will march on. This is the overwhelming narrative of our leaders. What are you saying to this, and who is actually to blame for this war?
I think it's very clear who is to blame and what are the origins of it. The origins really go back to the fall of the Berlin Wall. When the Berlin Wall fell at that point, it was imagined that there would be a discussion between, if you like, the West and the Atlantic forces and Russia, which was occupying part of Berlin at that stage, about how to come to some sort of future arrangement, some sort of mundo vivid between the two parties. And that never happened. And there were loose verbal agreements, not a meter beyond the line. And the Americans gave very clear, specific undertakings as they tried to absorb the three sectors of Berlin into a new alliance, the NATO alliance. And it was agreed there would be no further encroachment beyond the German border towards the east, nothing. And of course, that has been ignored. And we have had NATO moving closer and closer and closer. And 2008, even though Merkel and the other European leaders said, we didn't really agree with this, but in 2008, they said, well, Georgia and Ukraine must join NATO, putting NATO right on Russia's border. And as I say, this really goes back to, you know, Brzezinski and his very clear in his book in 1997, The Grand Chessboard. And he said about this, he said very clearly, he took the idea of the heartland as opposed to the, if you like, the Atlanticist world. Mm-hmm. And he said, Russia with Ukraine will be a power. Russia without Ukraine is weak and can be undermined. And it was from that we have had the sort of push of pulling Ukraine away out of, well, first of all, it was pushed out of the Soviet Union, but pushed it into the NATO sphere and into the European sphere, even though this, as I say, was somewhat illusionary. But the aim of this was always to prevent, if you like, the heartland forming a single powerful element. As Brzezinski said, we cannot allow any Eurasian challenge to United States global primacy. No Eurasian challenge from Russia or China or from the heartland. This was pure sort of Mackinder type thinking. But then he added to it that the pivot to weaken Russia, and this was 1997, he added the pivot was to take Ukraine and put it into the Western NATO camp. And that has been where we are going and being pushing. And this is why, you know, Putin said as early as 2007, you know, you do this, we are going to war. And it was, I think, even in the year, Bill Burns, who's now the CIA director as ambassador, wrote and said, niet means niet. Don't do this because it will lead to a war between the West and Russia. Russia will not accept to have Ukraine as a NATO state there to try and emulate, if you like, in their view, Afghanistan, the sort of Afghanistan bleed, which, by the way, was also a fake. There was no, it wasn't that the West because I was there at that time. And I know what happened. The West did not defeat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. What happened was it imploded. The Soviet Union was in the point of disbanding itself.
Can we go so far and say that the actual aggressor in the Ukraine is the West, or the United States of America?
You can. And I mean, the reasons for it go back even further, because at the end of this war, when I said there should have been an agreement, you know, when the Berlin Wall fell, where, you know, what is our field of interest? The Western field, you know, where do we draw the line? How do we sort of come to some sort of accommodation? And instead of which, I mean, we formed NATO out of the three sectors of Berlin. And, you know, Russia, you know, said, listen, we don't accept this. I mean, we've just lost, you know, 24 million people in this war. We're not, don't want a new militarization of the region and the area. But it goes even further back because at that time, at the end of the Second World War, not this, the fall of the war, but the end of the Second World War, all those people that I mentioned, the Ukrainians who were in the 14th Wehrmacht division, were led, if you like, by this man, Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the German intelligence service. He was working directly to the Führer at that time. And he had this whole intelligence apparatus aimed at the Soviet Union. And part of it was the Ukrainian element of it, who worked with Germany to obtain intelligence. And Gehlen was someone who was always telling. I mean, there are the stories of him. He was finally sacked. But he would tell the Führer, no, Russia is weak. It's all right. Even when Paulus's Sixth Army was being surrounded and at Leningrad was about to fall, he said, no, don't worry, and showed the Führer old photographs and old sort of aerial surveys saying, no, the Russians are weak, the Russians are weak. And of course, only at the last moment did he tell the German leadership, no, actually, I think it's really very serious at Leningrad for us. Anyway, his whole thing was taken in and formed the basis of the CIA intelligence structure. I mean, 4,000 people under Gehlen became, if you like, the CIA's sort of window on this part of Asia. And of course, it took with it the prejudices of Gehlen himself and many of those Germans, former members of the intelligence service that came there. So that sort of has persisted. And that's why we have, if you like, the strong connection between some parts of the Ukrainian forces and the CIA and the United States.
Totally interesting. I mean, this is really something that you cannot read in our newspapers or hear in our TV shows, but you are now analyzing in depth the whole situation. Now, one other observation. We have seen that after 2000, Germany and Russia went along increasingly better. You know, they were kind of growing together. The economy of Germany, the economy of Russia was becoming increasingly interlinked. This was in their mutual interest. And now these connections are brutally severed. And my observation is, I think that the Russians, Putin especially, as a man from St. Petersburg, he wanted to have good relationships to the West. He said, and especially to Europe. He wanted to cooperate with Germany. He wanted to. I mean, Russia considers itself a European power. And now, do you think that with this aggression or provocation from the United States, that Putin somehow was lured into a trap? Did he make a mistake with his intervention? Has he miscalculated, or was it, from his perspective, an inevitable war?
That's a very interesting question. You're quite right. I mean, he was in Germany. He served in Germany, not as an intelligence agent or officer. He was there as a legal advisor. His background is in law, and he was, if you like, there in terms of his legal credentials. He speaks very good German. He likes the West. St. Petersburg feels a particular attraction towards Europe. I just come back from St. Petersburg about 10 days ago, and I can tell you it's changed completely. St. Petersburg goes on. It's still the sort of cultural center in an extraordinary way. I mean, high culture in St. Petersburg. Not sort of pop culture that you find in some of the West, very high culture, which they're very proud of. But the tone of people was quite striking. They said, you know, we were so shocked by the hatred that the Europeans have showed to us. And they feel not only shocked, but they feel betrayed by it. There's no going back now. They just actually despise what they see as the weak leaders of Europe, the Macrons and the Scholz, and they don't expect anything from Europe. But they were very very concerned. And what you say was right, because I was there at the time when earlier, when with Putin at the meetings of Valdai, when the main discussion was about, you know, greater Europe. Vladivostok to Lisbon. And there were big discussions then about how greater Europe could take place and that this would occur. But I have to say, for whatever reasons, and I don't know quite why, it is now absolutely obvious from everything that has come out since that both Merkel and the French leadership were playing a double game and deceiving Putin. They had no intention of agreeing to Minsk. They were just playing along with it to get more time to increase the military forces of Ukraine. And yes, he knows, and he has pretty well admitted and said, you know, I was deceived by this, and that was, he doesn't call it quite, I don't think it will be described as a mistake, but yes, that was something that he didn't realize that he was being so deceived. And of course, naturally, he feels concerned about that. Just as I said, I found in St. Petersburg a strong sense of, it's a mix of sadness because, I mean, the culture of St. Petersburg, of course. But now they've come to see themselves really as the sort of last redoubt of real European culture and real Christianity. I mean, since, you know, the fall of Constantinople, it has become, if you like, something of a redoubt of the values of Western civilization. And so they see this as very much against the sort of new Western values of diversity, of social engineering to produce a change in the demography of European and American societies. And they just don't understand how we've gone down this route. So they do see themselves as something of a redoubt that is fighting for this, and that the only true European values, if I can say that, of Christianity and of civilization now reside in Russia in a paradoxical way.
I mean, this is very interesting also in the respect you mentioned before, that there is also some kind of a religious or cultural dimension in the Russian perspective, that they see themselves, or Putin sees himself probably as the torchbearer of Western and European culture, and he fights against the decadent West in the Ukraine. But the deep question to me, what I'm asking myself all the time is, I mean, isn't it contrary to the Russian interest? I mean, the Russians are now pushed by the West to the East. I mean, they have to work together with China. But with China, the Russians, Putin is a junior partner. And I think it would be much more in the interest of Russia to have a closer relationship to Europe and with the West, because Russia and China are old rivals. And do you really think that the bridge is now permanently broken between Russia and Europe? Is Putin now doomed to be the junior partner of China?
Well, I don't think I would agree with the framework you put around it, in the sense that what happened in at the end of the communist rule, suddenly these sort of old keys were dug out from desks and the church doors opened and people flooded in. And I've talked to people at some length about this. It wasn't organized by the Kremlin or by the leadership or even by the church leadership. It was an entirely self-igniting return to Orthodox religion. And it's had a huge impact. Perhaps 70% of Russians would say, at least on a poll, that they were practicing now Orthodox Christians. So it has had its huge impact, but it wasn't directed. But of course, it's become a really important component on Russia trying to move to see who it is, what they are now in this new world. And so that has had an impact. And Putin agrees. And I think you have to understand, when we talk about, you know, the BRICS and everything and about civilizational states means for Russia and China actually about autonomy and sovereignty, because it's only by going back to your sort of founding, your myths, your stories, your narratives, that your moral framework is there, that you can find your moral framework from all these, whether they're myths from the Bible or a different form, but these moral myths and stories are what binds the people together and gives it a sort of sense of values that are not just values that are prescribed by the Duma or by a parliament. These are values that are somehow eternal and which come from, you know, we all know what justice is. We can't define it, but we can tell justice and we can tell beauty and truth. Mm-hmm. And we know these things at a deeper core. And so he was trying to connect, if you like, in order to get back to the sense of what it is to be Russia. Russia is, you know, not just a state. It is a way of being in a collective and bigger way, and not just, you know, it's not just a state with an army, something much more serious than that. And so that's why, and that's also affects how Russians look at Ukraine and how they see the world. And they see themselves, yes, as having a redoubt. They are the redoubt of values, but not challenging the West, because in fact, they want to have nothing to do with wokeism or trans. I think they find trans, all the stories from the West about trans world, really horrifying and objectionable. So they don't have any aspirations to go back there. At the moment, there is no communications, and there hasn't been. I've been going back for some time, but there's no channel, real channel of communication between the West and Russia at all at the moment. So I don't think that. But as to the relationship with China, I think that is a mistake, this junior partner narrative that the West pushes out. I don't think that's how China looks at this, because China has long realized what is going to happen next. Because, you know, when you have someone like Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, going to China and saying, listen, you must stop your overcapacity because it's hurting our economies. You know, the Chinese understand that, saying, you know, we're no longer competitive. We've got to take action against you. As whether it's tariffs or whatever, but the Chinese can see that the West is also preparing militarily in the Pacific. And in a sense, you know, Russia has enormous resources, material resources. It has a leadership in diplomacy, which the Chinese try to emulate. But, I mean, they respect entirely Lavrov, and the diplomatic machine of Russia is incomparable as far as the Chinese are concerned. And they see Russia developing. I mean, you know, you go to Russia and you suddenly realize, you know, they're planning not for the next 10 or 15 years, but for 25 years. And it's humming. And if you go, you know, to Siberia and Vladivostok, I mean, it is the sort of the pulsating heart of the new economy that is coming. And China is part of that, integrally involved in it. I don't see this as an ideological rivalry in the sense, and nor is it an economic one, because there was a famous discussion between President Xi and Putin, and Xi was giving his view of why the Soviet Union collapsed. This was Xi's view on the Soviet Union. And he said, you know, you stop believing in your own values, and you assumed Western nihilism. And this nihilism led you to the place you're in. And Putin retorted to him and said, you know, we so much admire the way you've managed to sort of structure an economy that both encourages enterprise, but also hasn't lost sight of the need of the common good, of the human family and things. And he said, you know, we see entirely eye to eye on these things. So I don't think that this idea of, you know, the past enmity at all. I mean, Putin is arriving there, I think, in the next day or so in China. I think you'll see it will be a very strong support. China clearly supports the war in Ukraine, and it supports Russia's position on Gaza and the war in the Middle East as well.
How do you see Putin as a leader in general terms? If I talk to friends in Germany, especially in Germany, they say he's this ruthless dictator. He puts the opposition into prison. He kills his enemies. You know, his secret services, they're all over the place. We have to defend ourselves against this autocratic dictatorial style. He's the epitome of evil somehow. This is something totally reasonable people say, also in Switzerland. They're not fanatics. They really believe that Putin is this kind of terrible dictatorial leader. What would you say in such a conversation? What's your assessment of Vladimir Putin?
I think they've been listening too much to the sort of neocons of America, who have, you know, a very poisoned view. I mean, almost a sneering view of Russia and the world. And I think they have perhaps absorbed too much of that. I have sat, not one-to-one, but I've listened to Putin for hours at times. I would characterize him as the following: has an extraordinary mind, intellect. I mean, he's capable of talking for 3 hours on a whole range of complex subjects. There's no one giving him little notes. There's no one whispering in his ear from the side. There's no assistant coming in to him. He has an extraordinary view, a broad view of complex subjects. All, you know, it's not just one or two. He has this wide perspective over everything from the economy to the military to all of these things. He is, if you like, in command of, you know, organic Russia. And I would say the other thing is, what is so obvious, he's thinking 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ahead. Always nothing in the West, everything is immediate. everything is what happened today, what's in the news today. He is always standing back and looking at it. And he has also got, when he speaks and when he talks in this way, he has a touch of philosophy about it. I mean, by philosophy, I don't mean, academic philosophy, but I mean going deeper into the causes of things and why things are they are. Like all Russians, he knows history extremely well, knows history like we don't in the West. He knows history, but he's able to sort of turn this into, a very practical politics as well. So I would say, no, they have a view that is, I mean, clearly being prepared for the idea that we must come to some sort of conflict with Russia. And I'd say that, this is entirely unnecessary because what is, Russia doing? One is it has to prepare, clearly has to prepare against the possibility that actually the West will sort of develop, this war fever in the West will end up in a war, whether it is starts off only with tactical nuclear weapons or is something else, because the West is not capable of mounting a peer-type war with Russia. It doesn't have the weapons, it doesn't have the ability to do that. But nonetheless, he has to prepare for that. And so what we see in terms of the change in the cabinet and other all about preparing for how to bring new technology into use, how to see that it is properly being exploited, but also how do you actually run a war economy in such a way that it doesn't suck the oxygen out of the civil economy and that civil supply lines, everything else becomes distorted by the war economy. So he's always looking at this about the Russian people, about how to manage this and also secure the future of the Russian people. Mm-hmm. So he's not looking for that. What it is all about, finally, is that missing element that I said to you from the fall of the wall, Germany. Ultimately, there has to be a discussion between the Western powers, the North Atlantic, Rimland powers, and the powers of the heartland, Russia, China, about a modus vivendi between the two. Where are your limits of, what are your limits of interest? What are ours? Let's agree, that, Central Europe, Central Asia, and its economic sphere, this is not for you to disrupt. This is China and Russia's economic depth, and we won't accept that. There has to be. And in 21, they put forward some treaties and invited the West to have this discussion. And they said, let's talk about how we come to some sort of terms about it. This is the elephant that is missing from the room. There's been and there is no discussion about these issues at any level with Russia and also with, China, maybe there is some, but with Russia, there is no discussion of any substance with the West. There is one track two channel that I know of. There is something that is done over Zoom. And there is, if you like, the sort of de-escalation channel between the Pentagon and the Ministry of Defense in Moscow, to stop planes colliding and flying into each other, but it's not strategic at all.
Interesting when you talk to people also here, and I bring these arguments because a lot of people are watching our program who probably don't have the same opinion or they see it differently. And there is, or it seems to me at least, there is a convincing case to be made that Russia in the last 10, 15 or 12 years or something has turned more authoritarian. When Putin started, he said, it's not good if a leader stays too long in power. There are famous interviews with him when he was on his first campaign. He says it's important that the leaders change. We have these huge reports, you know them, of course, in The Economist, especially in The Economist, where they say he's closing down all these NGOs, the memorial. He's putting people like Navalny in prison. They die in his prisons. Other enemies, they somehow disappear. They get killed. How does that fit in your view of Putin? And how would you counter these arguments? Because the people that bring that up, they say, hey, you know, this is the character of Russia, and we would like to have a good relationship with Russia, but it's impossible because he's this crazy killer, you know, over there. This is a narrative. This is all pervading here, also in Switzerland.
I remember the view, because our, you know, Vice President Dick Cheney at one time disliked the fact that there were sort of people who'd actually studied Russia and knew a bit about Russia in the system. And so he invented what was called Team B. I don't know if you remember it, but there was going to be the CIA, and then there was going to be the Team B that would work to him, which would do a sort of alternative intelligence assessment to the official one. And the point was that Cheney made to them and said, listen, I don't need all this details about Russia. I don't want to hear all this stuff about Russia, particularly because I know the nature of Russia. I know who they are. They lie, they cheat, they deceive. And that's enough. So work on that premise. And then you don't need all the details and the data from elsewhere. And it seems to me this is part of the sort of the Cheney view of the world, because, you know, I just spent, as I said to you, I was in St. Petersburg and then in Moscow. In St. Petersburg, I was invited by, of all things, I mean, it's a bit surprising, but I was invited by the university run by the trade unions. They fund the university. And they funded this conference, which I had to give a talk on, about BRICS. What is the future of BRICS? I mean, this was a huge event with lots of people discussing about the future of the global order. You don't see that anywhere in the West taking place, that sort of deep discussion. And it was done by the trade unions. And it involved all the academics, the scientists, government, the Duma, and others. It was a big affair. And I sat through this, and I thought I was about the only Westerner at this affair. And I thought, you know, this is the other side of Russia no one sees. I mean, because these people, I mean, there was, you know, vigorous energy and debate about these issues, about, you know, about open borders or what we do, about the role of science in society, the role of, you know, which academic societies, who should be controlling. And people were throwing rocks at the sort of chair of the parliamentary committee and saying, you've got it all wrong. And he was hurling rocks, and others were hurling rocks back. I mean, you know, there is a bottom-up political process. And the academia and the institutions of Russia are very important in this whole structure, as is the Duma. And the chairs of the Duma, the parliament, are very important, people with significant structures. But equally, we don't understand that the policy of Russia is not decided by Putin in a personal sense at all. We never talk about it in the West. We never try and understand it. But there is this thing called the National Security Council, which is not the same as our National Security Council. It is a Security Council on which everyone sits, from Nabolina, the head of the central bank, to people who are from industry, the heads of government on this, as well as the military, as well as the security. I mean, the top people come and they discuss, and you can see it. I mean, it's visible. They have their own website. And every day there's serious debates about the problems with aircraft production. Or it could be about, why can't we produce better drones for the army? They have, a better structured government than we do in many places. And I say that avowedly as having been part of the government.
So let's make the point here. According to you, the conception Russia is this monolithic dictatorship is wrong.
It's junk. It's just rubbish.
It's interesting. Simply this is so thought-provoking. This is great. Let's switch to the. It's really, thank you very much. This is so interesting how you develop your observations and thoughts. Let's delve into or drill into the war right now and how this whole thing could end and could be brought to an end. But to start with, what's the situation now of the Ukraine war? Is it won by the Russians or is it still raging on? We read in our newspapers that it's totally important that we send in more weapons and more money, that there is a real chance that President Zelensky can somehow push the Russians back or hold the front. What's your assessment of the situation of the war right now?
The war is settled, but not yet over, I would say, in a simple terms. It's settled in that the Ukrainian forces have no ability to win or even to maintain what they now have in this period because, first of all, they just simply don't have men. I mean, you can get new weapons, you can do other things, but if you don't have the men to use them, you can't, they are of no good, no use. They've lost huge numbers and they are losing enormous numbers at the moment in across the front. And what we're seeing is a real, more importantly than that, they don't have weapons either, and they don't have air defenses. But that's not because the West hasn't tried to give them to them, but they've lost them. The air defenses have never been very effective anyway. But the West has destroyed many of the Patriot missiles and the RST missiles given by Germany. All of that's gone. So they don't have air defenses. Mm-hmm. So they're open. They don't have men. Russia has slowly developed and recruited, not by conscription, but recruited a bigger army. And it has reserves and it has men. And at the moment, the front is just collapsing. And what I mean by collapsing is that we saw at one particular sort of town, just as one example, Ocheretino, the battalion, the Ukrainian battalion that was defending it, just decided to abandon it with no orders. They just went against the orders and went. So immediately a second battalion, and actually more of an Azov-linked battalion was put in there, and they said they wouldn't go. They took one look, mm-hmm. and they withdrew. Then a third battalion was sent there, and they too refused to fight in the town. And we're seeing this in some places. The Russians are just walking into towns. There's no defense at all. And as I said a little bit earlier, I mean, there is a infighting between Bunanov, the head of military intelligence, and Skirsky, the general in charge of it, each blaming the other. Skirsky is saying that Budanov's people, the Krakan groups, fled and abandoned their posts and fled back. And Budanov, the head of intelligence, is hitting back at Skirsky and saying, but where are all these defense lines that we're supposed to have spent billions on? Because they don't exist. Where is the defenses? And there aren't defensive lines. I mean, all that money clearly has been stolen and is gone. And so the situation is absolutely critical and is also accelerating, again, if you like. I mean, I think we're going to be really on the edge, and very soon, in the next weeks or so, Russia will be on the Dnieper.
Do you think that Putin, do you see him conquering the whole of Ukraine, marching into Kiev?
No, not. I mean, first of all, that word of marching in, for Russia, and I've had a lot of these discussions with people who are deeply involved in this, Putin has always believed that, not all Ukrainians, as I say, some have a very different roots, but many Ukrainians are really part of Ruski Mir, the idea of the big Russian, you know, cultural, political, educational element. And so he, if anything, their aim is not to crush them or to, if you like, march into them, but is to find the way of embracing them and embracing them back into bigger Russia. So it's a completely the opposite frame of mind. And I've had these discussions with people who are, you know, certainly in the center of knowing what the thinking at the top is going. How do you do this? I mean, in some respects, you know, what has to be, what is difficult is those elements that I mentioned to you that were deeply anti-Slav, that were inherited the sort of...
These are the so-called Nazis. That's what the Kremlin calls the Nazis.
Well, they were at that time. There were in the 30s and that time, the Stefan Banderists were that. There's no doubt about that.
Ultra-nationalists, we've considered the ultra-nationalists.
That's a better word for it now. But they're ultra-nationalists. But the point was, as I was saying about the Ukrainian head of you know, the National Security Council, he describes the people of Donbass, Lunyansk, and Donbass as subhuman, as, you know, Slavs. We don't deal with them. And they used those sort of language.
And they considered themselves to be this Viking-inspired Nordic master race vis-a-vis these Slavic underdogs.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's problematic. But, you know, what I imagine is, as things go on, we will see some sort of implosion, both military but also political in Kiev. And, of course, I mean, I'm sure Russia knows exactly what's going on in Kiev and knows that there will be some people who are looking to find some political solution. From the very outset, Putin went in to Ukraine to achieve a negotiated outcome. And I tell you why, because, you know, during this time I was in Syria, and I lived in Lebanon, but I was going throughout the war to Syria at that time. And when Russia entered the Syrian war, they came in really, I thought, with minimal forces, maybe 5,000 men and about 30-odd fighter aircraft. Minimal forces for a big territory at war. And clearly what he intended was to do, that this was a show of force intended to spark the reaction of launching a negotiated process. And indeed, that's what happened. Turkey became involved. Erdogan was the mediator, and we had what was called the Astana process. It and hasn't gone very well.
Switzerland became involved too, as we have found out. They were already contacted to work with Ukraine in order to create the groundwork for a neutral state, you know, as neutrality workshops.
That's right. And you know, in a sense, what I saw was that, you know, at the outset of what happened in Ukraine, Putin followed the Syrian example. He went in there with a tiny force. As you saw, you know, they had a column that was supposed to drive up to Kiev, and everyone said, the Americans all said, oh, well, you know, he's trying to take Kiev. With 40,000 men, I mean, it wouldn't fill the Popolo, the Piazza del Popolo here in Rome. I mean, let alone, you know, a city of 3.2 million. I mean, it was a demonstration that said, look, we're serious. So let's sit down and sort something out. Anyway, that was pushed aside and rejected. And then they tried again in March, if you like, I think it was March 22, when there was serious negotiations and a big file that was produced, agreement between Ukraine and Russia at that time. And if you remember, the British Boris Johnson came and said, don't you dare come to any terms with Russia. Forget it. You just go on fighting. And so that died. So he never came to this. This is a misapprehension. He didn't come to impose a military solution. He came to try and, if you like, find a solution to the problem of a very hostile core component in Kiev that wouldn't deal with Russia, who hated Russia, extreme fanatics in Russia, find some way of going back to a situation where the bulk of the Russian-leaning population were both secured and could determine their own future about where they wanted to go.
Will the NATO countries, will the United States accept this outcome of the war as you describe it now, and which seems to happen on the ground? Will NATO accept it? We have some disturbing signals. Lloyd Austin in the United States, the defense minister, he said, well, if Russia moves on, there might be troops, NATO troops entering Ukraine. You have heard Macron saying that they will send troops. I mean, there are already troops, of course, not NATO, official NATO troops, but there are soldiers from European countries, from so-called NATO countries, are already in Ukraine. How will the West react to this plausible outcome of the war now? Will they just, you know, walk off as they did in Afghanistan and say, okay, we were wrong? Or do you see a kind of a counter reaction of the West?
Well, I think we have to divide it into two parts. But from now until November, I don't see that there'll be any change at all, and perhaps not after November. But I think that what you say highlights the danger that we are in, because all the proposals, first of all, let's be clear, there are no weapons left in the armories of Europe to give to Ukraine that would make any material difference on the battlefield. There are none, and even in the United States, there's no reliability. This is the point that, you know, that needs to be understood very clearly. We offshored our manufacturing capacity years ago. We went over to a different economic model, one of financialization. We produced financial products more than we produced real output. And so we don't have the capacity either to remilitarize. I mean, if we went to try and reindustrialize, that would be a 20-year project. You can't just change the whole, you know, framework, the structure of economy, and turn it into a military machine. And it would cost trillions. But also because we don't have that manufacturing, we don't even have the beginnings of it at the moment. We've lost that. Culturally, we have changed completely that process. So what we're getting is from people like Macron, I mean, clever plans which he thinks are try and produce a sort of opaque, if you like, deterrence. Well, we won't tell you what we'll do. We may do this, but we may not, and I'm not going to say what we're going to do because I want you to worry about it, Putin. I want you to worry that we might put troops on the ground. And then there have been ideas of NATO putting missiles right up on the border as close as they can in Romania or in Poland, and then firing at, you know, Russian aircraft in Ukraine from there. All of this is really nonsense. Is nonsense. I mean, first of all, you know, if France has some foreign legion in Slavyansk, which they may do, they may have 100 people. The message was very clear from the Russians called in the French and the British ambassadors to the ministry, and they said, if you put, whether they call them the French Foreign Legion or whether they're which are part of NATO forces, by the way, they're not somehow they are part of the defense forces of France. I mean, they're slightly different, but they are part of it. He said, whether you put that, we kill them. We will kill them and send them back to you in coffins if you want to send them there. And if you want to put a force in at Odessa, you will find that there will be a very, very serious repercussions from that. I think you should, you know, maybe even, you know, check the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. They said the same to the British, and they said, look, if you continue, because, you know, it's quite clear that Western military forces on contract or in plain uniform or whatever it is, are actually doing the targeting and the setting up of these missiles, and more importantly, are providing the radar and the electronic framework that allows, you know, Storm Shadow missiles to weave between the radar patterns of the Russians to hit their targets. All that's being done by the West, by NATO, directly as participant in the war. And the message to the British, which, I mean, has been publicly repeated by Putin, was saying, if you go on doing this, we will hit your troops wherever they are, implying even in Britain itself, if you go on doing this. Mm-hmm. So Putin has been very clear. Now, is it enough to stop this sort of language and this? Because, I mean, there's no means of doing it. I mean, A, Europe doesn't have the money, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have the armory to do this. And it certainly can't start up a military-industrial complex overnight. So is it enough? I mean, this is the one fear, because within Washington, there is an element, a sector of the population there, a foreign policy community, that advocate using tactical nuclear weapons then, if because they haven't got anything else. And Putin has said very clearly, don't go down that route, because we'll end up in a third world war. It's very dangerous if you go run.
Do you think
this is a danger of the United States being desperate and not wanting a humiliating outcome?
Mm-hmm. What will be the most probable outcome of this all? What do you see, any kind of settlement, which will it be a unilateral settlement by Putin, who has the success, military success? Then we have an implosion of the government in Kiev, we have a new government, and then we have this somehow Korean kind of, or Vietnam kind of separation of the country, a new Cold War, an Iron Curtain. What's the scenario?
No, I think it's very clear. He's waiting for, a surrender of the forces there, at which point then negotiations will start. But it's not going to be, there's no going to be frozen conflict. I mean, this is a United States sort of, the think tanks in Washington come up with these sort of magical thinking that they can sort of, that they can just put a bit of pressure on and Putin will freeze the conflict where it is and sit down and talk. Why would he do that? He wouldn't do that. What would he end up with? He'd end up with a rump Ukraine, who would then subsequently, either by stealth or in de jure, put into NATO. And then they will start the whole process of undermining Russia again from rump Ukraine or whatever it is. And we'll be back in the same place he was in 2014. Why should he do that? It would be very foolish to do that. So no, there's no question of him talking to, certainly not with the Europeans, who, as I say, in Russia are not held in any sort of esteem at all. And I'm very sorry that Switzerland has moved its position from neutrality, mm-hmm. because it was always able to be considered, and it's now more or less, not formally, on the sort of unfriendly list.
You gave just the keyword. I wanted to bring that up. I mean, we are having this conference at the Lake of Lucerne at the Birkenstock Resort, this so-called peace conference with Ukraine, but without Russia. Now our government is trying to bring in as much as much politicians as they can find. There's a huge debate in Switzerland about this this conference. The mainstream would say it's a good thing to do. Former diplomats say, well, you know, even if Russia is not part of it, it can be fruitful. It can, you know, start the development in direction of peace. What is your view on this peace conference in Switzerland?
If it is still based on Zelensky's plan, which was a complete withdrawal of all Russian forces from back to the, if you like, 22 lines. If it is based on his demands that of also the trial and the court processes against Russians, if it's based on his demand for recompense from Russia for the damage that has been inflicted, and if it is to be the Zelensky surrender document that is being discussed, then the conference is pointless. It will be a waste of money in running the conference, because first of all, I'd be surprised if there are many sides that will come and discuss that. Absent, and China certainly said it was going to have nothing to do with it, this conference. And I don't think much of the global South will be interested. They'll say there's no point. I mean, the Zelensky document is, fantastical. It has nothing of substance that one can point to that could be even a starting point for a negotiation. And I'm saying this as someone who's been, I've done negotiations with Iran and with many countries. I have been a negotiator in between different sort of spheres of this. I remember once an American, a very senior American, came when we were in Lebanon and saying, could we set up a channel with Iran for them to have a serious discussion about this? I said, yes, we could do that. And then when they came, no names. When they came to the meeting, and I had long talk. He's a famous name; you'd know who it was. But it sort of came a serious project, and he came, and he said, "Okay." And the Iranians were coming to the meeting, and he said, "Now this is how I'm going to handle it." And then he started off. And then there was this washing list of things that he wanted to include in it, the treatment of women in Iran, the question of how the prisons were administrated, the question of hijab, the question, I mean, it was demanding a sort of autopsy of the corpse of Iran. And I said, okay, forget it, go home. I mean, you don't start the sort of negotiation with someone like Iran. He said, but that's, the State Department told me I have to have all these questions in the list, and we've got to put them to Iran. I said, fine, but you don't have a negotiation, forget it.
The tragedy of abstraction. How will Europe come out of all this? In my view, Europe Ukraine is a big loser in this whole ordeal, but I think Europe will emerge diminished also as the loser from this whole conflict. What is your perception?
I think absolutely. I mean, extraordinary mistakes were made by the European leadership, our leadership, in the sense that, from the beginning, they went in, it wasn't that they were pushed into it by Washington. They went in with alacrity to impose sanctions on Russia. They didn't do their homework. They didn't work out, you know, that Russia wasn't the Russia of 97 when, if you like, sanctions almost brought down the financial system. 98, perhaps. I got the date wrong, maybe. But, you know, then Russia, a lot of its economy was, you know, connected with the banks in Wall Street and Washington. They didn't do their homework. And so they thought this was a slam dunk, easy job. I remember the French economy minister saying, oh, you know, a few weeks and it'll all be bust, and then we'll be able to sort of, you know, break up Russia and take what bits we like. And they made a great mistake. And then they made a great mistake in getting involved as effectively combatants in this war. I mean, they say they're not combatants, but I mean, they are certainly party to this war in this way. And I think the consequences are extraordinary for Europe, because the consequences of the sanctions have hurt Europe more than they've hurt Russia. We have raging inflation here in Italy, and I'm sure, I think less so in Switzerland, as far as I recall. But, I mean, huge inflation. There's a real sense of people unable to make ends meet, poverty. Small, medium-sized firms are having to either close down or go to the United States, where energy prices are much more, much cheaper. And, you know, heavy users of energy are deindustrializing from Europe, not reindustrializing. And we have a huge open door policy of immigrants who are going to have their payments here, which have been generous in Europe, but cut quite drastically because of the austerity that is inevitably coming our way. And they are going down the same path. And so now when the United States wants to ramp up a tariff and financial war on China, they think it's a good thing to join in with that, too, in the sense that somehow they believe that China is going to want to have a sort of special trading relationship with Europe, and that can exist when America is doing 100% tariffs on China on one hand, and that they're going to allow Europe a little sort of bijou corner where they can have their own sort of economic element. China knows that this is nonsensical. So I'm afraid the outlook for Europe is one of, I think, coming political unrest here.
In this gloomy outlook, desperately trying to find the silver lining to end our conversation.
Okay.
I offer you a silver lining, okay. A possible silver lining. Isn't it imaginable that due to all the problems you so eloquently describe, that there will be some kind of a paradigm shift politically in Europe? We will see new parties taking over, for example, in Germany, in France, in other countries, and realism gets back into the picture, and this kind of hyper-moralistic, evangelical-style foreign policy will be pushed into the background. And if we have a change of leadership in Europe, isn't there a scenario that in a rather short period of time, Europe could reach out again and say, well, we want to cooperate with Russia. We want to cooperate with China. We don't want to be the slaves of the United States. Isn't it possible that such a positive outcome could realize itself in the nearer future?
This is what I said in St. Petersburg when I was there. And I said, because people were complaining about the West and, you know, that it was impossible and that, you know, it was like the siege of Leningrad again, and which is highly exaggerated. And I said to them, look, we are in a, if you like, in something of a civil war in Europe. I mean, there are elements of a cultural and civil war. It's an extended one, and it's got a strange character because half the population would say, what? What are you talking about? Everything is normal, isn't it? And you say, no, there is a struggle, both quite obviously in America, but also in Europe, a cultural war is at hand. But look what's happened. The West has been defeated, badly defeated, in Ukraine, and NATO has proved to be a hollow shell. In the Middle East, the Middle Eastern conflict is not only delegitimizing much of the Western leadership, but it is, if you like, actually creating the conflict within the West itself, mm-hmm. Between the various components. And thirdly, you have Yellen going to China to announce that our economic model is broken and that we can't repair it. And I said, of course change is coming in Europe. But the point is, and what I said to the Russians there, I don't think I'm giving much away, but I said to them, look, you know, we don't even know if there is an election in the United States at the end of it, someone may take office, but does he take power? Because you have all of these, if you like, fiefdoms that have their own foreign policy. I remember going to the Treasury in the U.S. once and saying, you know, but why aren't you doing this? Because there's a presidential executive order ordering it. That may be the president's policy, but it is not the Treasury policy. Ours is different. And it was the same in many areas. ComSen, CENTCOM in the Middle East, has its policy. We saw that in Syria. The president ordered the withdrawal from Syria, and CENTCOM said, I'm very sorry, you may be president, but we know better, and refused it. And then you have the CIA, even more difficult, and you have the Justice Department. How do you manage that? I mean, how do you reform that in the end? Or do you just have all of these warlords pursuing their own separate policy? In which case, how does Russia engage with this difficult outcome? And so I was saying, you know, the change is coming, and it's important what you just said and what I said. It's coming, the change, but you're going to have to be a bit patient till you see it actually taking place, because these are serious problems which will be addressed before these other foreign policy issues, the domestic issues of what's happening in America, and it'll happen in Europe, I believe, too. Then for sure, change is coming. But, you know, don't think it's worth talking to Americans at this point. It's not worth spend your effort on things that are more productive, because how can they talk to you? You stand for everything they hate with the present administration. You know, it's like talking to the Bolsheviks. Don't expect that the Bolsheviks are going to like you or be helpful to you. They're not. They detest everything you stand for in terms of your values. So, I mean, I agree with you, but I think equally you need a certain amount of caution about how much is realistic and what will be possible.
Mr. Crook, many thanks for this conversation, really in depth. I mean, to sum it up, we have the picture of a confused West, which is in a state of war with itself, within itself, a West who kind of tried out this aggression in the Ukraine, and now he sees that his strategy has failed. How to get out of it? I mean, there is a semi-optimistic perspective at the end.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to our next week's conversation, when we dive into an even more depressing topic, one can say, that the conflict in the Middle East, which is an abyss at the moment, and you have already touched upon it. Many, many thanks for that, and I'm really looking forward to continue our conversation next week.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. Thank you so much.